States. I mentioned this issue with Boeing early in the show. It's actually fairly involved. It's hard to tease out any one big Boeing story because they all seem to be big Boeing stories. But my solution, as it always is to call up Andrew McIntosh from the Puget Sound Business Journal to help set me straight on what exactly is going on with Boeing. The most recent story, he has a scoop today on Cathay Pacific. The headline is Cathay Pacific defers Boeing 77X orders beyond 2025, cuts 8,500 jobs, closes regional carrier. Andrew McIntosh, thank you for joining us. What exactly is going on here?
Well, Cathay Pacific is Hong Kong's main airline, and they have been hurt harder than anyone else in the airline world because of the international travel restrictions on business between and flights between Hong Kong and Europe and Hong Kong and North America, particularly Seattle. You know, last year we were all celebrating the launch of a direct flight between Seattle and Hong Kong with Cathay Pacific, and that all ended with COVID. And they were planning to refresh and renew their big airplane fleet for these long trips that they run with between North America and Europe. And basically, since March, their business has cratered. And one of the ways they're trying to survive is the layoffs that they did, thousands of people today. And they literally shuttered a regional airline of theirs, sort of like Alaska's Horizon Air. Well, the equivalent in Hong Kong was shut down today. And the other thing they did to save cash, and so they could literally, they said, survive going forward, is to reach agreements with jet makers like Boeing to defer their aircraft orders that they made during the salad days of 2013, in their case, for the 777X, Boeing's new, huge, massive jet. You may have seen it flying around Puget Sound on test flights. Now they're saying they're not going to take any until, quote, beyond 2025. Now, what that means remains uncertain. The chairman said they had reached a deal with Boeing following months and months of negotiations. Boeing isn't saying anything about it, much less what the impact will be on the program in Everett. You know, and Cathay Pacific was one of the original airlines that signed up to buy the new plane. And so this is just Boeing has already cut production on that 777X. And they ordered 21 planes, and we're talking $7.5 billion worth of product. So if that's put out 5 years, you can imagine how people are feeling over at Boeing Everett today.
And the question then is a deferral still mean that they are in any way contractually obligated to buy these planes at some point, or could a deferral end up being as just the first step toward a cancellation?
Well, a Boeing airplane contract is about as tight as a Hollywood prenup, Mike. And so they're not going to let anybody out of a contract. Boeing, though, you know, to its credit, is a very customer-oriented business, as it has to be, you know. And so they're trying to work with the airlines while trying to keep their manufacturing and supply chain operations alive. And so there is, I'm sure, some money that will be paid down the line. And in order to defer these deals, we had another airline CEO from the Middle East, from a carrier, who said basically Boeing, you know, needs to suck it up and help its customers in these hard times, or else when the hard times are done, then people will remember how they were treated by Boeing, you know. And so Boeing with Cathay Pacific, this is a very long time customer. They've made the deal, and so the orders are not canceled, so Boeing doesn't have to take a hit. But they are deferred until, you know, the airline has a better sight line on how the world is going to recover from this pandemic. And right now, you know, a lot of their business is focused on these long haul flights, not like Alaska, which is you know, and Delta, that a lot of their flights are domestic. And so they can, you know, muddle through and keep things going. But Cathay Pacific has just been blown off the map in terms of world travel because of all the flights canceled and their airplanes are grounded. So they don't need any new planes, and they don't have the money to pay for it. So Boeing, I think, has rightly found a way to accommodate their needs. And, you know, maybe down the line when they need them and everybody has vaccines and the world gets back to normal and we all... The interesting thing about this pandemic, Mike, is I was tuning into a Boeing market forecast not too long ago, and the executive who was on the call said this thing is not like other recessions. It's not like 9/11. It's not like the Great Recession. People have money. They're staying home right now. They're sitting on their wallets. They're not traveling, but they have money and they want to travel, and they're absolutely just sick of being at home and want to you know, people are already drawing up their plans for trips when right. The world returns to normal. And so there's a sense of, well, we got to be careful. We'll plan this for 5 years out. But when things come back, then I think we're going to see a lot of people traveling and that the industry will begin to have some kind of a more sustained recovery.
We're speaking with Andrew McIntosh, Puget Sound Business Journal aerospace reporter, Boeing reporter, obviously, as part of that. Andrew, what is the mood in Everett? The 777X is an Everett plane, and with the news of the 787, all of the production being shifted to South Carolina, the 777X is the plane for Everett. Is everyone there pretty unhappy about this order deferral, or do they feel like this is just the atmosphere we're in right now?
They feel it's just kind of like the salad, you know, the landscape they've been given. Nobody expected this. This is not some kind of error or miscue that they have made. They're just swept on up in it like other jet makers. Airbus has slashed the production of its own huge jet like the 777X, the A350-1000. And, you know, they've laid off thousands of workers, too. Boeing has. So this is sort of a global thing that they've been swept up in. It doesn't make it any easier for anybody in Everett. And it doesn't make it easier for the suppliers who all signed up, you know, 6 years ago. Let's not forget, this is going to be Boeing's best new juice. And the big contracts were signed, tax incentives were granted to Boeing and the supply chain to invest in the tooling and machines that they needed to produce the parts for this big plane. And, you know, it flew in January, finally, after a few hiccups, like all development programs with airplanes. And it was just a huge excitement. And then, bam, they got sideswiped by the pandemic. And so you got a feel for them. I know their engineers are frustrated. The machinists are frustrated. Everybody's trying to put the best face they can on this literally this, you know, unfortunate situation.
So,
You know, we don't know what's going to happen next, other than that there will be more deferrals. We know Lufthansa's in talks. We know that Qatar Airways is in talks to defer the 777X. So what Boeing will likely do, and what you may hear next week, is them slowing down the 777X program even more.
That is Andrew McIntosh, Puget Sound Business Journal, Boeing reporter and aerospace reporter. Andrew, all right, so let's setting aside the big news about Cathay Pacific, and now apparently there's other talks about other airplane order deferrals. Let's talk a bit about the 737 and its move toward certification. Good news from Europe about regulators there. Where are we at on the 737, and when is it going to? I know that you there's a lot of people left at the side of the road who have predicted when the 737 is going to fly. So I am going to ask you anyway, when is the 737 going to be back in service?
I have no idea. And even if I did, I wouldn't put my neck in the noose.
Understood.
You know, they've made a lot of progress, and they've been working very hard to fix the problems with the airplane in terms of the flight control systems, some software issues. There was foreign object debris in some of those jets that was discovered as they were parked up in Moses Lake and in Seattle. So they've just got, like, you know, just a series of things that they're trying to work through and issues that they're working through. But the thing that triggered, a couple of things happened this week. There was the statement from EASA, the European Aviation Safety Regulation Agency, and their leader sort of said some off-the-cuff remarks to a reporter saying, you know, he was pretty happy with the changes that Boeing had made. Now, the reporter over there took that to mean that EASA was approving the plane to return to service. Now, that's not what happened, and there's been no statement from that European agency that they're returning the plane to service. So kind of like the media is getting very good at getting ahead of itself on, you know, the MAX's return, because so many people have so much riding on it in terms of, you know, investors and suppliers and Boeing and all the workers. So that was one of the perhaps exaggerated moments of the week. The second was American Airlines put the MAX on its schedule for the end of the year with a flight on December 29th. And, you know, everybody jumped on that. Oh, American scheduling, and it must be coming back. And, you know, they had said they were going to train their pilots on the upgraded software system and the flight systems in November. That has slid sideways. So I don't know. And I thought, gee, I recall that I've heard that from American before. And sure enough, I went on their website and I counted at least 10 different times when they said the MAX was coming back in posts. And they put them one on top of the other. And if you want a link to that, you can go to our webpage on the Business Journal. And maybe I will make sure that people can see it, or go to my Twitter account, PSPJ Aero. But they weren't alone in all this. American Airlines, you know, they got 24 that are parked, so they were very happy with the airplane before the MAX crisis. They had said it was performing well. It burnt a lot less gas and was very reliable. So you can see why they would want to get it back flying. Now, but they weren't alone. Like I said, you know, there was lots of people saying the MAX was going to come back. And we all remember Boeing former CEO Dennis Muilenburg back in October, months after the grounding had begun. He told investors and airlines and reporters that the MAX would be back in the skies by the end of the year. And we know it wasn't, and he was fired last December. So he was a victim of one of those victims he talked about on the side of the road. Calhoun, his successor, David Calhoun, who's been in the job since January, he said the MAX would be back in the skies before midsummer, and we all know that it's not.
Right.
And there's so many people who said, you know, and including journalists, you know, I don't want to call it fake news. I want to call it uninformed reporting. But Reuters reported September 2019, that the plane would be flying again in early November, quoting a senior industry source. And now people are talking about a mid to late November return, all right, but it's a full year later. And even that, as we know, is not certain. And then there was an analyst who I quoted, and so here's my mea culpa, all right? I'm part of this. And I quoted him in the story saying, not about when the MAX would return, but that all the MAX issues would be quickly forgotten, and the plane would come back into service, and Boeing's orders and backlogs with its best-selling jet would largely remain intact for the most part. And as I have covered over the past year and a bit, the MAX has lost now close to 1,000 orders worth about $4 billion. And Mr. Jim Corridor, the analyst at CFRA, has moved on.
So when we look at this, and we're talking right now with Andrew McIntosh, Puget Sound Business Journal, Boeing reporter, Boeing and aerospace reporter. When we look at this then, so it really is a question. We keep getting reports of the hare winning the race, but the fact is it's going to be the tortoise. This thing is going to move along at a very methodical rate before we finally see that plane up in the air. And I will never again ask you when it's going to fly. We'll find out when we see it, I suppose. But when you look at the whole Boeing ecosystem now in the area, obviously we've got these order deferrals, which are going to affect manufacturing. Once the travel industry even rebounds to the extent that it will, when you look at the whole Boeing ecosystem in this area, the big stories about it selling off a building, maybe reducing its footprint to some degree in the Puget Sound area. I mean, how do you see Boeing, you know, 10 years from now in this area, still is a big, big, big player? Or do you feel like Boeing is slowly, like, you know, reducing its presence in the Puget Sound, whether it wants to or not?
Well, this question has become one that people are talking about because we learned last week that the Boeing Commercial Airplanes headquarters in Renton, which is known as Long Acres, because it was built on a former horse racetrack, is up for sale. And as Boeing is looking at it to raise some millions of dollars, in this case it would be over $100 million, to help pay the bills, to keep the lights on as it sorts out the MAX situation, gets its finances back in order. And they're not doing it just here. They're doing it in California, where they've sold off, you know, $250 million worth of properties down there and other places as well. And the question, so when you put the question to Boeing, they say, well, the plan is, yes, we'll sell the office buildings, but that's because we want to put our leaders closer to the manufacturing facilities. So you're going to see Boeing airplane people go up to Everett or closer over to the Renton plant. And also they're saying that, like everyone else who has lived through COVID, they are reevaluating their need for all this office space now that most of their people are working from home.
Right.
And obviously it's a lot cheaper and for everyone who's doing that. And so they're saying, you know, they're going to set up these situations where people can go in one or two days a week and have their meetings, but largely work from home because they've discovered, like everyone else, that their workers are happier and more productive not being in an office building. So but all that said, the one thing that Boeing leaders have said consistently, including this week, Bill McSherry, Boeing's big senior Washington State, I will call him a fixer, but other people will call him a government relations person. He had a Zoom call with economic development and business leaders up in Snohomish County this week, and he said at least 10 times, we are here in Washington State for the long term. We are committed to Washington State for the long term. And 10 years from now, when we get out of this morass, we will still have a very large presence here in Washington State. So at least the talk is reassuring and comforting, and certainly the people from Snohomish County appreciated hearing that message. But when a company is, you know, left, right, and center, and there was properties in Bellevue they sold, now in Renton, and others in other parts of the region that are being sold, you begin to wonder whether there's one message coming from one side of the company and locally, and another message coming from corporate headquarters in Chicago.
That is Andrew McIntosh, Puget Sound Business Journal, Boeing reporter and aerospace reporter. Andrew, thank you once again for joining Cairo Nights. We really appreciate it.
Anytime. My pleasure, Mike.
Coming up on Cairo Nights. So it appears there's a problem with belching and farting cows, and as it relates to climate change and global warming. And there's a plan now to fix how gassy our cattle is and to make our beef maybe a little less damaging to the client, a little less damaging to the climate. Coming up right after the break. We'll be making love. not a... No, it actually is a big problem. I was going to say it's not a big problem. It's a bigger problem than we realized. And it's very, very difficult to deal with this problem without somebody snickering because... Well, because of this. And sorry for those of you with delicate constitutions. Maybe you should cover your ears for the next 4 seconds. That is a cow fart. And that is actually, apparently, a massive problem, not just in the United States, but in much of the developed world. Here's a story from the New York Times today. Let's just start at the start of the story. Randy Shields looked out on a sea of cattle at the sprawling Wrangler feed yard, 46,000 animals milling about in the dry panhandle as air as a feed truck swept by on its way to the pens. Mr. Shields, who manages the yard for cactus feeders, knows that it's most basic. The business simply takes something that people can't eat and converts it into something they can. Beef. In other words, the cattle graze, and then the cattle become bigger cattle, and then we end up eating them. But the process about how cows turn all of that fiber into flesh is called enteric fermentation. It produces tons of methane. A potent, they refer to methane as a potent planet-warming gas that cattle mostly belch into the air. And with about 95 million cattle in the United States alone, including more than 25 million that are fattened for slaughter each year, the methane has begun to add up. So in the United States, there is now a move afoot. Not necessarily, I mean, there's the folks who feel that we can go to a plant-based diet and eliminate a lot of this, and that's entirely true. But I think there's a lot of people in the States who don't care to go to a plant-based diet and would like to continue eating meat. And so this is a third path that is a possibility in management of cattle that is being discussed now among scientists and cattle farmers. So at the center of all of this is Cargill Corporation. If you've been in farming or ranching, you probably know Cargill. They're the giant food and agricultural company, and they supply feed to the beef industry. These are not generally the feedlots that have, you know, you see around Washington State, the grass-fed beef. These are the big feedlots that produce, you know, beef for McDonald's and produce beef for restaurant chains and produce beef for the fast food industry and ground beef that you would buy in a Costco or a cash and carry or something along those lines. They have started doing a study on what they can actually begin to feed cows that essentially makes them emit less methane, either from belching it out or from farting it out. The story goes on to talk to a Jim Fromiel. He runs an independent feedlot in Hereford, Texas. It's about it's a much smaller one than the one I mentioned before. Well, the other one was 46,000 head. This is 20,000 head, which is still gigantic. And he actually said is that, look, if they could provide him with a he is a rancher. He also believes in that methane is a contributor to climate change. And he said this, look, if Cargill or someone else can put a supplement in the feed that reduces the methane, he would and doesn't harm the cattle, doesn't harm the product, the meat in any way, he would happily use it. But here's the odd thing that the story points out. So when you use a feedlot, and I used to deal a lot when I was in California with John Harris, who was the owner. I'm not sure if John is, I'm assuming John is still around. I don't know. John Harris is the owner of Harris Ranch, and you may have seen Harris Ranch prepared products up here, but it's also a giant cattle ranch in the southern central valley of California. And John was a big time political donor, really interesting guy. And he would talk about the fact that you have so much beef to move through that you can't keep all of the cattle out on rangeland. At least you can't if you're operating an operation his size. And I know that there are different points to be made about that subject. But the thing about the feedlots is that feedlots actually move cattle to weight more quickly. So, you know, weirdly enough, while feedlots get blamed for a lot of things, including the overfeeding of corn to cattle who don't digest it fairly effectively, they also do spend less time actually on the planet. And so that methane production drops, weirdly enough, in a feedlot as opposed to range-fed beef. So the story continues. Like, well, what do we do about this problem? I'm an occasional red meat eater. I used to be a real regular one, and I'm just from a health standpoint, I eat less of it, a lot less of it now than I used to. And so, and I think that that's probably going to be what I'm going to stay with. But if I were to say that I'm not tempted from time to time and don't indulge from time to time, I would be lying. Of course I do. And when I do, I try to make some decision. Weirdly enough, apparently according to the story, I'm making the decision that actually is producing more methane on the planet. But the story is a really interesting look because cattle farmers, I think people sometimes don't see hunters and farmers as people who are also stewards of the land. In California, for example, one of the big reasons that the Pacific Flyway, which is the chain of lakes and marshes that migratory birds in the western North America use to go back and forth, north to south, south to north, that Pacific Flyway has been largely taken care of, at least in the California, in the section of California, by duck hunters. Weirdly enough, they're the ones who preserved a lot of the land away from development and kept the marshlands intact. And so millions and millions of Canada geese and other birds use that to go back and forth. The rice farmers as well in the Sacramento area use that. And so I think people sometimes make a mistake that they don't see ranchers, hunters, people like that who ostensibly are killing animals as also stewards of the animal's territory. And I get people's point about if you are against killing and eating of any animal, none of this maybe will flow logically for you. I understand that. But it is, in fact, true that these ranchers and the ranchers interviewed in the New York Times care deeply about the environment and are all worried, and they're looking for some sort of solution. And they understand also that it may involve smaller, you know, herds of cattle, and it may involve more some sort of way to feed cattle in a manner that they produce less methane, because the overall production of beef in this country is considered a pretty big polluter in the environment. And so, you know, to the extent that they can do something about it and maybe curb a little bit of that cow farting, which of course is, you know, annoying to all of us, I think it's a pretty interesting thing. And I think on top of that, it's nice to see that this story isn't just demonizing the beef industry, but actually it's showing about how these group of people are trying to get together to solve a problem that they are not entirely responsible for creating, because in fact they wouldn't be creating it at all if there weren't a demand, right? So coming up, we're going to have the random question robot, of course, as always, in a 9 o'clock big conversation with Stacy. Super interesting story she brings to us and her own reaction to this about ending up on a list of top radio shows, but the weirdness of ending up on that list is what she wanted to talk about. Coming up after the break.
Look at me and I begin to melt, just like the snow when the ray of sun is felt. And I'm crazy about you, baby, can't you see? I'd be so delighted if you would come with me.
That's right. What's the name of this again?
Baby Come Back by
No. I know the song.
Player.
No. We're the soft rock.
Soft Rock Wednesday.
Soft Rock Wednesday.
Can't forget that.
Can't forget that. Can't get that out of my head. It's like a worm in my brain. All right. But what also can't get away from is the random question robot. It has followed us once again into the room. It knows it only has one job here, and that job is to make us seem less than we are by asking us questions that we cannot answer as fully as we would like, because we just don't know the answers. And so, Shane.
Yes.
Ready? I can take that yes as a ready.
Yeah, I think I'm ready.
Okay. Frank?
Bring it.
All right. What is something, we'll start with Frank, what is something your friends would consider so you? In other words, if they saw it or saw someone else doing it, they say, oh, that's very Frank.
I think they would probably, if they saw somebody just saying whatever was on their mind and kind of openly about how they feel, that they would say, yeah, that's very Frank.
Very Frank?
Yes.
How about you, Shane?
I think it would have to be a comment on somebody's style. I've been known to kind of blend together different phases of my life, like skater Shane and cowboy Shane. So I think if anybody sees anybody that just kind of mixes up styles and looks like they're going their own route, then they usually always bring my name up.
Eventually, skateboy Shane, then, right?
Yeah.
Cowboy,
yeah.
Skateboy.
I'd say for me, I'd say anytime a group of people are together and someone is late, they would probably say, that's Mike.
Are you always late?
Not all. Well, so it depends on who you ask. I would like to think that I'm not and that I have legitimate excuses every single time. I don't know what my friends would say. They're polite around me, but I suspect they wouldn't say anything I would like. All right. Next question. If, starting with, did I start with you, Frank?
Yes.
Starting with you, Shane, if you could give everyone just one piece of advice, what would it be? And this is your chance to give, because literally right now,
wow,
everyone is listening. What advice would you give them?
If I had to give any advice to everybody, I would just say it's all going to work out in one way or another. Truthfully, especially with the times that we're living in right now, you could, you know, try to be happy and try to put on a fake smile and be positive, but sometimes you just got to be real with yourself. And to be honest, you know, just looking forward and just like trying to push through. So just letting everybody know it's going to be all right.
All right. Frank?
Be real. And by that, I mean be authentic. Be who you are. Don't try to be somebody else.
All right. I think I would just say, I think the thing that helps me out a lot is never assume intent. I think that that can you a lot happier in life if you don't always build a narrative in your head that whatever happened, someone cut you off in traffic, that it was about you,
yeah,
and not maybe about them just not checking their mirrors. And I mean that metaphorically as well. Here's a good one. I'll start with me.
Sure enough.
What qualities do all of my friends, the question is, what quality all of your friends have in common? What quality do all of my friends have in common? I would say, I'd have to say two things in particular. I don't think one of them doesn't have a good sense of humor. And I don't think one of them isn't loyal. I think that I value people who are kind of there for you, thick and thin. And I really value people with a sense of humor. I think I learn more about people from their sense of humor than virtually anything else. For me, that's a real gateway drug for my friends. And so I would say those two things. Shane?
I would say honesty. A lot of my friends are brutally honest. There's been a lot of times in my life where I've been on something or been excited about something going on, and I would go to share it with my friends, and they would just completely shoot me down in some of the worst ways possible. And the thing is that sometimes that's, you know, sad, but at the end of the day, their honesty and their integrity to just be real with me has always been the best part about them, and they all have that.
All right.
I would say authenticity. They're just their own people. But the other thing is, they're all decent people. Every single one of them is kind. I don't expect any of them to go to war with another human being. I don't expect any of them to do dirt against another human being. They're just nice people.
That doesn't surprise me at all. All right, do we have time for one more?
We can do a lightning round.
All right, lightning round. Here we go. Ooh, this is a, where is the best place to take a date? Shane.
Oh, best place to take a date, mini golf.
Mini golf, that's a good one. Frank?
Any place in Hawaii.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty good date.
Yeah.
Best place to take a date? Wow, I don't know. I'm thinking that a good place to take a date... God, it's been so long. My girlfriend and I, what we always tend to do on our date night is actually we have a place where we always go have kind of the same dinner, sit at the bar, and we just dig it because of the conversation. So I go take it to any place where you get to pay attention to them and not pay attention to everything else. I'd say that's probably the best
date.
Very
good.
All right. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we've got Stacey Jo coming in. Real interesting, long conversation with Stacey Jo about an interesting story she found that she was actually a part of right after the break. Don't.